Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
You look a little tan and orange both today, kiddo.
I got a little sun not too long ago in the fine state of Florida.
Yeah, I get to know.
And when I came back, it was 18 degrees here.
Yeah, that was my post-Hawaii trip. It was 5 degrees.
Exactly.
But what the heck?
But yeah, now that I'm getting older, now that I'm almost 40,
well,
going to Florida.
There's life after 40, trust me.
Oh, no, I'm delighted to be 40.
Yeah, I was amazed I got to be 40.
But going to Florida in the wintertime is not really that bad of an idea.
No, and the older you get, I think, the more attractive it becomes.
Exactly.
Snowbirds.
We were extremely fortunate. Some dear friends of ours, our neighbors, actually, Howard and Tracy, they go down there, and they invited us to come see them. So we got to stay in a very pretty warm place for a long weekend.
Wow.
And while we were there, we made arrangements to go to the Florida Everglades on an airboat ride.
Wow.
Which, I mean, honestly, it was an extremely unique experience.
Yeah.
We just delighted over it. It was pretty darn cool.
So looks like fun.
Well, it's just so completely different than anything you would ever do.
Yeah.
And Andy said it. He said it, you feel like, because you're literally just in inches of water. And then you're on this airboat, and then you kind of glide over even when there's no water. But you feel like you're in a flooded farm field for as far as you can see.
Were you scared?
No, not at all. Uh-uh. And then the first alligator we saw, super cool. It was scary.
Bet.
It was good.
Yeah, that would be.
You know. But then you got used to, because then when we went to this area where we were fishing, everywhere you looked, there were alligators. And there's pictures on the website, so you've got to go check them out. It was super cool. Of course, we didn't go swimming. and I don't think I'd want to go out there at night when the alligators feed.
No.
But it was really, really cool.
Did they come around and open their jaws up and say,
yeah, they did.
You guys looked pretty tasty?
They were all right around us when we were fishing.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It was really, really weird.
So you sat in the middle of the boat, I take it.
No. But really, you know, it's like you kind of get used to the fact that they're there and that they're not going to, like, jump out and grab
How
you.
How many feet away are they?
Like,
you can touch them if you want.
No. No. And actually, one where we were fishing, you know, you could cast your line out and bop one on the head if you tried to, which we didn't, of course.
No.
Because our guide was very, very clear about respecting, you don't mess with the alligators, you don't ever try to feed them,
yeah.
You don't throw them a fish, you've got to respect that boundary of, you know, because you don't want them too friendly and think they come around the boat and think they're going to get fed all the time.
I've never made friends with an alligator.
Good, and we didn't, we respected it. So anyways,
I'm proud of you.
Stick around. You'll hear a little interview that I took with Captain Shane Miller, who was our airboat captain and guide in the Florida Everglades on a big, loud airboat.
They call him Crash Miller, right?
No. He was very good.
Okay.
He was very respectful.
Okay.
Anyway, plus he has like this little cabin out there too. So we got to go to this little cabin, which is like on a teeny little island out in the middle of the Everglades. And it was all very like rough and cool.
I bet he likes his work.
I think he does.
I have that sense,
I think
he's
delighted by it.
Right.
Anyway, that's coming up. And also Florida is known for citrus. Bob and I wanted to find out a little bit more about the history of the citrus industry in the Sunshine State. Oranges aren't necessarily native to Florida, are they?
No.
So how did it all
begin?
Come together?
And why do I get that box of oranges every year from my mother-in-law in Florida?
Exactly. They're good. Interestingly, too, when we were in the Everglades, we rode along the reservation boundary line in the Everglades from the Miccosukee Reservation, the Seminole Reservation. And that was interesting for me, too, because, you know, you're literally riding in the middle of nowhere, right?
Yeah.
And then you see a sign and it says the Miccosukee Reservation, you know, don't enter unless you're, you know, you have to be licensed to be able to go in there, too, if you're a guide.
That's what you teach.
And the Seminole, the Miccosukee, they own citrus groves.
And I hope so.
Very smart business plan. They own their own citrus groves, which gets turned into juice, which they sell to Seminole owned Hard Rock cafes.
and their casinos probably across
absolutely.
Southern Florida.
It's a fine economic development plan, if you ask me.
Yeah.
So very interesting. So yes, it's all about Florida today on Homegrown, whether you like it or not.
You'll like it. You'll like
I think you'll like it. It's very interesting. All right, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Hidden Hill opens again for the 9th amazing season.
Nine years?
I can't believe it.
Wow.
Yeah, April 3rd, 4th, and 5th, and The 4th and 5th are Sunday and Saturday. We're having fun. It's called our Kite Flying Extravaganza. Mm-hmm. A guy named Richard Langdon, who's a 60-some-year-old kite maker. He's a hippie. Mm-hmm. Never get over it. He makes kites, and we fly kites, and I'm just excited about it. It'll be fun. So we're open Saturday and Sunday afternoon, and come on out and fly a kite.
All right. Sounds good.
What's going on in Wichita State?
Well, we went chicken shopping the other day. We went up to Metzger's and we ordered some more chicks. So this will be a whole new experience, Bob, because you know my hens, my Bard Rock, my Bard Plymouth Rock, they came to me as full grown.
Yeah.
So these will come to me as teeny tiny little babies.
You gonna put them together right away?
No, because the grown ones will kill the babies. Yeah. So we'll probably keep them down in the basement for the first week because you got to keep them really warm and all that. I will definitely let everybody know how it goes, but we will be getting baby chicks. We got two Brahmas, two Araucanas. Those are the ones that lay the blue eggs.
Yeah.
And then two golden laced Wyandottes, just to try some different varieties. And you got to keep adding to your flock every year, you know.
I've always said that.
So,
will they sleep at the foot of your bed?
No, they won't. They will eventually go to the coop with all the other ones. But we are going to have to successfully keep them alive those first couple of weeks.
Are they house broke?
No, they'll have their own little potty box reality in the basement. I'll cover all the bases that are necessary to keep everything, you know, on the
I believe
up.
In you, kid.
All right. So, yes, this is a new adventure, and I'll keep you posted, okay?
Chicken feathers.
All right. There's a couple of events going on around town. On April 4th, Bob, there's a fabulous tree giveaway that's going on.
Yeah, it's a joint Arbor Day event in the Highlands. They give free trees to all Metro Louisville residents. Four Highland Neighborhood Associations are coming together, plus individuals and communities. It's called Plant for the Planet. There'll be 12 to 24-inch bare root seedlings to be given away, include both canopy and understory species. The event takes place Saturday, April 4th, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Warheim Park, 1832 Overlook Terrace, four blocks from the Douglas Loop.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Good opportunity to get some trees for replacing all those that got destroyed in the ice storm.
Exactly.
So, definitely something good for the community. Also on April 4th, Bob, the Norton Commons Farmers Market opens. Farm market season is fast approaching, folks. So I'm sure in succession, we're going to find that most of the farmers markets are going to be opening, you know, sometime in the month of April, for sure by early May. But Norton Commons, April 4th, 9 to 1 p.m. And then on April 11th, the Community Farm Alliance is hosting a Louisville Food Summit. It's their first one that they're putting on, and it's called Everybody Eats from the Ground Up, the first annual Louisville Food Summit, and that's going to take place April 11th from 9 to 3:30 at the Metro United Way, their building there on Broadway. So you can check out our website for more details on all these events at WFPL.org.
You can tell it's April because things are cranking.
They are cranking, and I have a drawer full of grapefruit still from Florida. And as such, our minds got to thinking about how on earth that whole Florida citrus industry manages its affairs. So we dialed up Andrew Meadows. Andrew Meadows is the Director of Communications for the Florida Citrus Mutual. Florida Citrus Mutual represents Florida growers in trade, in legislation, in regulatory, labor, and market affairs. Andrew, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a good day here today in Florida, and we're happily growing oranges and grapefruit and tangerines down here.
All right, and a little bit more, too, I bet. Citrus is not native to Florida, but it's certainly known as being a major citrus state. What makes the state so ideal for the crop, and where did citrus come from to begin with, and how did it land itself in Florida so comfortably?
Yeah, you know, it originally came to Florida in the late 16th century. Ponce de Leon brought it in through St. Augustine, planted it in that area, and around mid to late 18th century, it really blossomed into a commercial industry and grew from there into the industry that we have today.
When did the industry really emerge as an industry, and what were the changes or the innovations that sort of allowed it to be, you know, people just growing oranges and selling them out of crates to all kinds of orange juice products that you can find at any given store. Do you know what I mean? It's huge.
Yeah, you know, originally Florida oranges kind of capitalized on the tourist trade here in Florida, and people from up north really saw oranges and citrus and grapefruit as kind of a taste of sunshine. And
right.
Since our season runs in the winter,
snowbirds would bring them back home with them.
Exactly. It was kind of a great delicacy or delight for people up north to get. And, you know, Tropicana, now 90% of the oranges in Florida go towards juice because of their juice content. We do have a significant fresh industry, but the majority of Florida's industry makes juice, and Tropicana, as everybody knows, is the major brand. They really pushed the envelope and started transporting back in the mid-19th century, transporting juice to stores up north in the Northeast and New York area, and they really helped the industry flourish as a commercial entity.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about like concentrates and stuff like that? Was that something that they did back then, or was that an innovation that came later?
Back then it was mainly shelf-stable orange juice, but mm-hmm. frozen concentrate was invented, I believe, sometime in the 1960s, and that, mm-hmm. again, you know, was an innovation that helped packaging and shipping, and now, you know, frozen concentrate, if your listeners aren't familiar, is basically orange juice with the water removed,
mm-hmm.
so you can ship a lot more of it and then add water back in at the destination point and pack it. So mm-hmm. Certainly that was an innovation that helped flourish the industry. And, you know, further on, maybe about the 1980s, NFC, not from concentrate, which is basically pasteurized orange juice, which is heated to a temperature to kill the bacteria,
mm-hmm.
And then cooled down, was really took off, and that was another innovation that helped the industry grow. And right now, really, NFC is considered Florida's premium product.
So that's what we would buy in the grocery store that says not from concentrate, that's already, you know, ready to drink, essentially, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
That's
fresh squeezed, as
that
it
were. It's got a fresh squeezed taste,
mm-hmm.
and it's basically pasteurized,
gotcha.
Orange juice, yes.
Right. Yeah, Andrew, I'm curious, what happens to all that pulp and rind? It must be tons and tons of it.
Well, you know, very little goes to waste. A lot of that, the vast majority, is made into pellets for cattle feed.
Huh.
So a lot of the processing plants that squeeze it into orange juice also have a derivative business in cattle feed.
Huh. That's interesting. Corn and orange rinds.
Exactly.
gives it a whole new sort of meaning, after all. I wonder if you could, like, turn it into mulch and stuff, too.
I don't know. You might be able to do that. If you try it, let me know, and
I'll
be sure to publicize it.
Well, you hear a lot about vitamin C, but what all is in oranges that make it so healthy for us?
You know, we're obviously proud of our product and think it's one of the healthiest beverages available. It's got, obviously quite a bit of vitamin C. An 8-ounce glass has a full day's supply. You know, we also have potassium, folic acid is a main component, and that's important to pregnant mothers. We all know the benefits of folic acid. We've got quite a bit of antioxidant content as well, and you know, if you've been following some of the research lately, antioxidants can help neutralize free radicals in the body. So our industry has really been promoting the health benefits of orange juice, a way of separating us, because when you go to the store now, you're literally assaulted with different beverages. Now I've heard statistics that there are 20 to 25 new beverage introductions every month in the grocery store. So we really think we have something to hang our hat on and separate us from the pack.
Let's talk a little bit about the major players worldwide when it comes to oranges. You know, you mentioned the Valencia orange. Do they grow Valencia oranges in Spain, or does California and Florida
Sure.
sort of corner the market when it comes to oranges? Who else is growing stuff?
Well, a quick lesson there. Florida, as I said, 90% goes into juice. We have about 10%
right.
that goes into fresh.
Uh-huh.
California's flip of that. They basically produce oranges for the fresh market, and then they have a little bit of a juice business. We like to say that that's because of the juice content of Florida oranges. With our rainfall and our soils, we really produce a heavy, juicy orange. And if you hold it next to a California orange, it's actually heavier because of that water or juice content. That's domestically. You know, Texas and Arizona also have smaller citrus industries that mainly produce for the fresh market. Mm-hmm. Now, the major global competitor for Florida in the juice industry is Brazil. And Brazil has a massive orange industry. They produce about twice as much as Florida does in the Sao Paulo region of the country. And they import some juice to the United States, but most of their juice is consumed worldwide. Europe is a huge market for them. The United States is a net importer of juice, so Florida cannot make enough juice for the consumption in the United States, so it has to be augmented with Brazilian juice.
Okay, I see.
So how many acres would Florida be growing, and what's the net worth of the crop?
Florida grows, we're around 600,000 acres, and with prices the way they are to farmers this year, we're expected to be around $1.3 billion in cash receipts.
Is it still growing? Is the crop more acres every year, less? Or what?
It's actually been less. You know, we were hit by a couple of hurricanes 2 years ago, which significantly impacted the acreage. We've had some disease issues with canker, citrus greening. That's caused the removal of 75,000 acres. So we've had a pretty steep decline over the last decade in the acreage in citrus in Florida.
What are some of the things that have impacted the price of orange juice in the last couple of years? Because it, you know, it does continue to get a little bit more expensive. Clearly, weather is going to be one factor, but what other things are really dictating the prices here?
Yeah, you know, oranges and orange juice is a global commodity, so it's affected by supply and demand. And the supply side in Florida has been shrinking, as I mentioned, not only because of development, but because of the hurricanes and the pest and diseases you mentioned. We have citrus canker. We eradicated about 70,000 acres because of canker over the last 5 years. And we also have a disease known as citrus greening, which has a lot of the industry concerned. It is a fast-spreading disease. It's spread by something called the Asian citrus psyllid, which is a bug. And we're concerned. You know, we've got research. We've almost 100 research projects underway to try and find out how we can understand greening, how we can understand the citrus psyllid, and how ultimately we can develop a long-term solution to the disease. But, you know, I kind of liken it to citrus's Manhattan Project right now. It's that serious. And, you know, it, really, not to overstate it, but the future of the industry is at stake. And we're coming together, and we're cautiously optimistic that we can figure this thing out and continue as a viable industry.
Well, Andrew, to that end, how long does it take to get an orange tree in production, and how long will a tree typically last?
You know, it used to take 6 or 7 years to get a tree to the point where you could harvest a crop off it. Now we've actually accelerated that to about 3.5 years.
Yes. How long will a tree last then?
You know, it depends. There are some really old trees out there with on good solid root stock, but you're looking at about 30 years for the life of a tree.
How are they harvested? Are they is it manual labor or is it all mechanical now?
Yeah, it is manual labor. They, you know, climb large ladders with a canvas bag and dump it into a box, which is then transported to the edge of the grove and then picked up by a truck. And now in the rural highways of Florida, you'll see 18-wheel trucks packed full of oranges or grapefruit heading to the processing plant. So we've also got a pretty focused effort to develop mechanical harvesting. And, you know, more and more acreage is being mechanically harvested, and it's really makes sense for us as an industry to pursue that. It's kind of an interesting process. You have one of the popular models actually has kind of fingers on this whirling machine, and the machine will come up to a tree's canopy and stick these fingers in there, and it'll whirl around, and it'll knock the fruit off the tree into a basket at the bottom, and that basket will collect the fruit and then haul it to the edge of the grove. Another one is a trunk shaker, which actually grasps onto the trunk kind of gently vibrates the tree so the fruit falls off into a basket, which is then hauled to the edge of the grove. So there's some interesting mechanical systems out there, and that's going to, you know, continue to be a pursuit of the industry to perfect that and ultimately implement it on a large-scale basis.
Are there, like, trade issues when it comes to oranges that you all have to sort of protect your growers from, or
yeah,
you know, watch?
Yeah, you know, there's a tariff on frozen concentrate orange juice imports, and so we've been very active, Florida Citrus Mutual, with protecting that tariff and making sure that you know, the countries that we compete with, mainly Brazil, are on a level playing field, because they have a lot of labor advantages and their costs are considerably lower than ours. There is a tariff, and we've been active in Washington and protecting that tariff and making sure it remains there.
But just
with frozen, that's really one of our core responsibilities.
Okay. Right, but just with frozen concentrate?
Right.
Okay.
I was curious. I guess I sort of assume that all agribusiness from coast to coast is getting more and more corporate. Is that true in your industry too, or is there still room for a guy with a few hundred acres and a plow?
There is. You know, we've got a pretty diverse industry in terms of growers. We've got some large growers, some large corporate growers that grow 15,000, 20,000, 25,000 acres. But we've also still got, I just was at a grower's the other day who had 60 acres. So we've got across the board. There's been some consolidation, not only at the grove level, but at the processing level as well. But that's really kind of a economic phenomena in the United States, and we're no different. But we're still a diverse industry, and our organization, Florida Citrus Mutual, has across-the-board membership from those 50-acre growers all the way up to 20,000-acre growers.
Yeah. So basically everybody just sort of sells their stuff to the major processors, and it gets turned into our concentrate or our fresh juice or our pasteurized juice.
Exactly.
Yeah, like
some do it on a cash or spot market where they sell their fruit for whatever is being offered for it, and some sign long-term contracts, which helps manage their risk. Most growers have a good mix, just like an investment portfolio. You have your blue chips and your bonds, and then maybe you have some money that you play around with some higher risk investments. So most growers kind of balance their portfolios that way as well.
This is either a brilliant or totally dumb question, but you know, green is in now, organic is in. Is there an organic tree as compared to a fertilized tree?
There is organic. There are organic growers. There's an organic farm not too far from here in Lakeland, Florida, and so there is certified organic juice and certified organic citrus as well.
As far as you know, is it hard to grow oranges organically?
It is. I've been told by several people that it is, because Florida is, because of our climate and because of the moisture, don't know if either of you visited here, but you know bugs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Bugs are
lots
a problem
of bugs,
in Florida,
lots
and that's
fungus.
No different in agriculture. So it's very difficult on a large-scale basis to produce organic crops here in Florida, but some, you know, they see the value in it, they see the demand for it, so they're willing to take on those extra costs and extra hurdles to do it.
Yeah, sure. My brother-in-law just sent me 15 oranges from his backyard, so I guess there are people who are doing it organically.
All right. Andrew, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. If you need anything else, please give me a call.
Certainly will. Andrew Meadows is the Director of Communications for Florida Citrus Mutual. Florida Citrus Mutual is a co-op of sorts looking after the best interests of growers in the Sunshine State. For more information on citrus, please visit our website at WFPL.org.
After the break, Janine travels miles inside the Florida Everglades where alligators lounge in the sun and water birds fill the sky. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Look yonder coming down the railroad track. Look yonder coming down the railroad track. It's the Orange Blossom Special. Bring my baby.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Janine Wishy, and I'm sitting in the middle of the Everglades in Florida with our captain for the day, Shane Miller. He's invited us to his camp, in fact, but in order to get here, we had to take a pretty long airboat ride. Shane is a fishing guide and airboat captain, if I can say that, and he's been taking us around today. Shane, thanks for having us.
Oh, you're welcome. Hope you've enjoyed the ride so far.
We have, for sure. Tell us a little bit about, I guess, just the, like, a snapshot of the Everglades and where we are.
This is all sawgrass country with cypress heads, and all the cypress heads run north and south. And all the watershed we get actually comes from a spring out of Lake Toho, a little creek called Shingle Creek. And it starts out about the size of a basketball, flows down a creek into Lake Toho, which flows into Lake Cypress, Lake Hatchinal, into Lake Kissimmee, the Kissimmee River, which runs into Lake Okeechobee, and then we get the watershed from Lake Okeechobee. Uh-huh. And this water flows from here into the Gulf of Mexico through the Shark River Valley.
So the Everglades is just sort of a stopping point from fresh water down to the Gulf.
Correct. And it gets filtered as it comes through here with the limestone that we have and the sawgrass.
We'll talk about the airboat in a little bit, but you know, as we were going through, I mean, there's literally just a couple of inches of water beneath us, and maybe a little bit more depending on what time of the year it is. But why is it that the water even sticks around? What's going on underneath what we can't see?
Well, actually, this is all a watershed, and the aquifer is around 60 to 80 foot beneath the limestone underneath here. It doesn't come up. This is all from rainwater and from the lakes, like where I told you. Some of this water took, 1,000 years to get down here from that spring. It's a pretty unique situation, you know, to think that all this water come from one little spring millions of years ago. And a lot now is the water is controlled by the water management, and they have weirs and little dams here and there where they can, you know, manipulate the water level out here.
Let's talk about the flora and fauna that we find in the Everglades. And of course, I think the most exciting is really the alligator. Is there only one species of alligator, or are we going to find different varieties in the Everglades?
No, you just have one, and that's the Florida alligator. And we do have saltwater crocs. They're not here, but they're down in Shark River Valley.
So what is the general temperament of the alligators around here? What do people need to know?
They're more afraid of you than you are of them. They'll move out of your way, you know, and they're mostly nocturnal feeders. And during the day, they're just laying up, resting, absorbing sunlight because they're cold-blooded.
And at night when they're feeding, what's their primary diet?
They're pretty aggressive at night. Fish, turtles, birds, frogs, snakes.
We saw tons of birds, none of which are songbird-like birds that we're used to at home. Mostly water birds, long necks, long wings, long legs. What are some of the most common water birds that folks are going to see out here in the Everglades?
The herrings and the ibis are your two most common. And the herrings, we have the great herring, which is the larger bird, and the white herring and the white ibis. And the ibis we call curlew, is a nickname for them. And then you got your, we got a few ducks, Florida mallards out here. And some of the buzzards, which we call black eagles. Yeah. And
could you, in fact, see some eagles out here?
No, we don't get any really eagles or ospreys out here. You've seen the roseate spoonbills. They arrive here in the wintertime, and there are only a few of those, about a dozen, that'll come to that canal area. That's like the center of attention out here. It's the food source for everything.
So wildlife is the whole thing is not just wetlands, wet everywhere. You do see like little islands, if you will. So those are the places that are going to maintain black bear, deer, and the wild turkey?
Correct, yeah. And they'll hop from little island to island. And as you look out here, you'll see, they could be within 500 yards to a mile apart. And they will travel from island to island for food source and shelter and everything else.
Let's talk a little bit about the airboat. You've been doing this for about 10 years. What are the sorts of things that you have to understand about the boat and the landscape in which you're traveling, to be safe and successful?
Well, airboats are just like a regular boat. The same rules apply. You yield to the right. You got to have the safety, the flares, and the life jackets, all like you just would regular go boating. Same rules apply.
What about the technology of the boat and sort of just, in terms of what it's doing on the water? Because we had mentioned before, there's very little water really that we're traveling on. It's all sort of propelled through a big fan off the back. Can you tell us a little bit about the technology of an airboat?
It'll ride up on top of the grass and kind of hover once you get up on plane running, and it can run dry ground or deep water. And we have most of the boats are made out of aluminum or fiberglass, and they have polymer underneath of them, most of them, which allows them to run dry where it doesn't crack the hull or anything like that. You could literally, and the horsepower is just depends on different motors on the boats. You can have anywhere from 300 to 800 horsepower on your motor, and it just allows you to run wherever you want to go. And then the secret is you don't want to have less horsepower where you're going to get stuck out here, because it does get dry and you'll be running through mud and dry ground. And if you stop, you could get stuck. So you've got enough horsepower where you can get back up on plane and run. And once you get on plane, it'll hover, about an inch above what you're running.
Is there anything similar to a trail of breadcrumbs out here in the Everglades? How do you get used to figuring out your way around? Because there really doesn't seem to be any sort of steadfast, hardcore sort of markers. I mean, perhaps there is, and I just don't notice them. But, how'd you learn to maneuver or navigate around the Everglades and not get lost? Because I would imagine you could get lost really easy.
Yeah, especially at nighttime, it's real tricky running around here. But having a sense of direction, you're north, south, east, and west. And one little secret is the cypress all runs north and south. So if you see the cypress heads, they're running north and south. And at night we run GPSs, okay. And with a light, and you can see, the water, the trails, and where the water is.
Shane, we did a little fishing earlier today as well when we were in the canal watching all the alligators rest and sun themselves on the rocks. What are the kind of fish? I mean, can you actually fish out in the wetland part? Are there fish there, or do you have to go to these canal areas?
In the canal area. And when the water gets up high, the fish will get out in the grass area, and they get spread out and they're harder to catch. So when the water levels drop, it's a lot easier fishing in the canal, and we mainly in the winter months, December, January, February are prime months to fish out here. We catch Florida, largemouth, black bass, and Oscars. And we have brim in there, and we have gar and catfish. And we average around 60, 80 fish a trip, so quite a bit. And we catch them up to around 8 or 9 pounds. I did have one that was close to 10 pounds about 3 weeks ago during the spawning period. So that was one of the largest fish we have caught out here.
What's your feeling about the water quality in terms of if you did want to eat the fish? What do you feel like the water quality is out here in the Everglades?
Well, right, I think it's poor right now due to the fact that we get all this runoff from Lake Okeechobee, which we can blame that on the sugar farmers. All the pesticides and the runoff we get from there comes down here. So the water quality is not that great, and they're trying to work with the farmers right now to fix that, but it's going to take, you know, quite a few years to clean it up.
So has there been a noticeable impact on the wildlife that's here because of poor water quality? Are universities in the state sort of looking into it at all?
Yeah, we have a Florida Atlantic University. Some of the students are biologists, and they come out here and do some testing, look for exotic plants and such not. The bass that I've seen physically, you know, have lesions on them, and that's due to pollution in the water, so you can tell that there is something wrong. And the mercury count is a little high right now out here.
So this time of the year, the winter months, the water's a little bit lower, so I would assume in the summer, when you all typically get more rain in the afternoons at least, is that when the water level is higher, since this is essentially a humongous watershed?
Yeah, pretty much August, September. That's when the highest water is here. It'll be about 2 foot higher than what you see now. And if we get any tropical storms or hurricanes, of course, you know, that'll raise it quite a bit.
So is there anything that, you know, dramatically changes in the Everglades between that fluctuation of water being really low and the water being a lot higher?
The higher water will kill a lot of the plant activity out here. It drowns it out. So you want a medium in there where, you know, it doesn't affect the plant life too much. We get a real nice orchid off the lily pads and all that. If the water's real high, we won't get that, and it'll drown them out and kill it. And then you get the dead vegetation that settles into the water column, which is not good.
So a ecosystem that's fragile, I suppose, to be sure.
Yeah, it's very fragile out here. The water management's trying to do the best they can, you know, to control the water levels out here. And when the water does get too high, they do shut it down where you can't access this area by airboat at all due to the wildlife and the plant habitat.
Shane, thank you so much. You've been a great captain. We've enjoyed it. Definitely one of the most unique experiences I've had, and we appreciate it. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Shane Miller is our captain for today. He's an airboat captain and a fishing guide. He is from Naples, Florida. And, of course, to check out pictures of Shane, of our fishing, of our airboating, of alligators and more, you can go to our website at WFPL.org. You're listening to Homegrown on WFPL 89.3 FM. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain Bob Hill with, because of the forthcoming April 1st event.
Uh-huh.
It's Bob's Goofy April Fool's Quiz.
All right. We haven't had one of these for a while.
That's totally redundantly redundant, actually.
Okay.
A Goofy April Fool's Quiz.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's fun. These questions were based on an April Fool's Day botany quiz I found online. These things actually happened.
Okay.
More or less.
More or less.
And I want you to do well because you're getting close to a pretty special day. We'll get to that later.
Okay.
Okay. Number one, an April 1st story in the London Daily Mail said a tree had been found in the city of New Cross in England that bore the likeness of A, George Washington, Ben Franklin, and King George, B, Princess Diana, Madonna, and Michael Jackson, C, Queen Elizabeth, Prince Philip, and Prince Charles, D, Paul, Ringo, George, and John, or E, Tony Blair, Winston Churchill, and Margaret Thatcher.
The Beatles.
Sorry. Bah. Queen Elizabeth, Prince Philip, and Prince Charles. A tree.
All three likenesses?
Yeah.
Hmm.
April Fool's.
Okay.
Number two. National Public Radio ran a story on April 1st, 2005, saying there had been a drop in the maple syrup consumption triggered by the low-carb craze, which supposedly caused a serious problem for the New England maple tree industry. That problem was, A, built-up maple syrup pressure was causing the maple trees to explode, maiming nearby residents. Tree trimmers were having a difficult time because their saw blades were getting stuck in the heavy sap. C, tree limbs were bending to the ground under the weight of the untapped sap. Or D, the International House of Pancakes threatened to close all its stores in New England.
Hmm. Either exploding or the tree limbs hanging to the ground.
You got to pick one.
A tree limbs hanging to the ground seems more... Ah!
Maple trees are exploding.
Oh, well, I was close. The limbs hanging to the ground seems more reasonable. Well,
I know,
it was on NPR.
Is,
come on.
This is April Fool's.
Okay.
On April 1st, 2002, the British supermarket chain Tesco published a newspaper advertisement claiming it had successfully developed a genetically modified whistling carrot. A carrot with tapered air holes in its sides that would allow it to whistle while being cooked. The ad resulted in a competitor supermarket announced it had developed A, turnip that could sing God Save the King, B, green beans that could play the piccolo, C, bags of tea that could simmer for 2 weeks, D, powdered fish and chips, just add water, E, all of above, F, none of above.
Powdered fish and chips.
None of above. I just had a good time on that one. On April 1st, 1957, the much-respected BBC news show Panorama announced that thanks to a very mild winter and the virtual elimination of the dreaded spaghetti weevil, Swiss farmers were enjoying a bumper spaghetti crop. The announcement included film footage of some Swiss farmers, A, hacking away at enormous strands of spaghetti, B, dancing barefooted on huge piles of spaghetti to create spaghetti wine, C, peasants pulling strands of spaghetti down from trees, or D, villagers marching through the town at a spaghetti festival carrying 20-foot spaghetti forks.
A.
Bah. Peasants pulling strands of spaghetti
down
from trees.
I'm not getting any right.
All right, well, who would? It's April Fool's. Last one. One of the two people involved in the on-air production of Homegrown is soon going to celebrate her dreaded 40th birthday. And her name does not begin with Bob. Her 40th birthday will be A, the day of her choosing, B, April 8th, C, the last one she will count for a while, D, April 34th, or whatever's left, a very special day.
None of those. You were close. I'll start celebrating on the 8th since my birthday's actually the 9th. How about that?
I get
that?
To go, bruh. Well, it's April Fool's.
All right. Happy April Fool's, everybody.
You betcha.
Let's not fool some of our listeners who have sent in some questions, Bob. This one is from Paul Leach. He has a question about the Chinese chestnut. He's got problems with chestnut weevils. He was wondering... if milky spore would work, because he knows that that kills grubs and other larvae in the ground, and it will not. It will not work with the weevil. He does refer to the fact that he tries to clean up the chestnuts as they fall to reduce the problem. The only chemical that I know that's labeled for control of chestnut weevil is 7, which I just think is a dreaded chemical.
Yeah.
And he likely does not want to use that.
No.
So continue doing what you're doing in terms of picking up old burrs that fall to the ground and then the chestnuts pop open. Another thing to recommend, because we have some Chinese chestnuts too, and I honestly go out every day and harvest in the fall. And as soon as those burrs start to crack open, that's often when the eggs are laid. So if you can get them even before the burrs fall to the ground, but just as soon as they start to crack open a little bit while they're still on the tree, you may get them before the problem sets in. But just continue doing what you're doing or use 7, but I wouldn't really want you to do that. But for some good information, you can go to the University of Kentucky Department of Horticulture. Their website has all that extension information on there, so you can look at real specific information about controlling nut pests. Okay?
Absolutely.
All right.
Yeah, I've got an equally complex but interesting question from someone named Pat. Basically, the setup is he's got a natural limestone cliff, some land he owns, landscape land, It's about a 20-foot drop at a 45-degree angle, and there's a little kind of a river in the center of this area. He wants to plant something that will flow down from the top of the hill to the bottom of the hill, and what amounts to dry shade, pretty much, in the woods, but to create kind of a river effect, because he didn't want to put a fountain that far from his house. Great idea, right after my own heart, I think. Two possibilities would be, I think, periwinkle or plumbago. Both have little cool blue flowers. They're both kind of tough little plants, and they both have that flowing effect to them. Now, the plumbago is not going to bloom until late in the summer. It's one of my favorite plants. It's a beautiful
that
blue flower.
It is really nice.
The other thing you could do, really, and think about this, is just get a bunch of liriope and just plant it real tightly in there and create this flow of green going
or
down.
What about different sedums and stuff?
Well, it's dry shade, though. I don't know if it would work.
I think that he had trees taken out, though, didn't he, Bob?
Well, he said the site would still be considered full shade.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. It wouldn't work.
So, it wouldn't work. Although, the other thing is, since he doesn't know yet, the trees just went down, he might have more light than he thinks. So, sedums, I've done sedums, too. I've created waterfalls with sedums.
But they are going to do much better in a full sun situation.
But I think anything, periwinkle, plumbago, liriope, would make a nice little river. I'd love to see this thing. I hope when he gets it done, he'll invite us to come out and see it. Cause
there you go.
This is a man after my own heart.
All right. One more question. This one's from Garrett. He's a relatively new gardener, and he's purchased these to plant onions, beets, carrots, lettuce, peas, black beans, banana, peppers, and tomatoes. And he's wondering if any of these are particularly susceptible to rabbits.
Susceptible to rabbits. That's backwards, buddy.
Yeah. because he's fairly certain that there's a mama rabbit with her babies in his backyard. So he's wondering if there's something that he can do to deter them from eating those things. Because honestly, all of those things are somewhat susceptible to rabbits. They'll chomp off a echinacea bloom if they're hungry enough.
This is where the rabbit meets the road when those two things come together.
One idea, kind of an old school sort of approach, is to use blood meal. But I don't, to sprinkle the blood meal around plants. But, once it rains, that's gone. Another one, you can get that hot pepper wax spray.
Yep.
We were talking about this earlier with the group, trying to deter squirrels. And it's difficult. And, unless you can create some sort of barrier, it's hard to keep them away. And anything that's going to be irritating to their nose is a relatively good deterrent. So the hot pepper wax has cayenne pepper in it. And if you spray it around their plants, if they're not that hungry, they will likely try to find food elsewhere.
Yeah, because that's my other thought. Rabbits are pretty self-sufficient. You can put a little cage around your garden and they'll still do fine, I think. Or you can just take lettuce cuttings and throw them to them.
See what happens.
Whatever happens.
All right. Well, good luck on that, Garrett. I'm going to try to figure out ways to keep the groundhog out of my garden this year.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
If you have a rabbit or squirrely question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, several of my friends have said you were all wet and I've defended you endlessly.
Good.
But apparently here's some proof that they may be right.
They may be. Yeah. And in honor of the Everglades, the Latin word of the week this week is euliginosus, euliginosa, or euliginosum, which means of swamps or wet places.
Isn't that interesting? I've never seen that word before.
I have, because one of the salvias that I've grown in the past, it's a little on the invasive side.
Yeah.
But salvia euliginosa, which is a swamp salvia.
I want to call it uglinosa.
Yeah, so do I.
It's hard not to.
It's hard not to. It's U-L-I-G-I-N-O-S-A.
Euliginosis.
So salvia euliginosa is a swamp salvia. Solidago euliginosa.
Bog goldenrod.
Bog goldenrod.
Yeah.
Betula euliginosa.
The good old birch.
A birch.
Yeah.
Dryopteris euliginosa.
Wood fern.
Lotus euliginosus.
There's a pattern developing here. They all like wet places.
They do indeed.
Greater bird's foot trefoil.
Gallium euliginosum.
The fen bedstraw.
Delphinium euliginosum.
Swamp as in wet larkspur.
Nephalium euliginosum.
Well, I love the sound of this.
I do too.
Marsh cudweed. I bet cows love that.
I was thinking that too.
Yeah.
And Vaccinium euliginosum.
Oh, yeah, the bog blueberry.
Or also known as the bilberry. So if you see euliginosa, euliginosis, or euliginosum, you will absolutely know that that plant will be happy in the wettest area of your garden.
And your feet's going to be wet, too, if you're sitting there looking at it.
I guess so. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Washington, D.C.'s Cherry Blossom Festival.
Homegrown is produced by the dryly humorous Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm the dryly humorous Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.